From the studios of Kootenai Co-op Radio, this is Deconstructing Dinner.
And welcome to Deconstructing Dinner, a syndicated radio show and podcast produced each week at Kootenai Co-op Radio CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia, and listened to around the world on radio stations such as KOWA 106.5 FM, Olympia, Washington. I'm John Steinman. From time to time here on the show, we get the opportunity to share the work of other producers of food and agricultural media. Most often, it's been the work of radio producers. But on today's show, we'll feature the work of the Agro Innovations Podcast, an exclusively online-based weekly program offering information that nicely complements what we offer here on Deconstructing Dinner each week. Back in January 2009, the Agro Innovations Podcast featured Deconstructing Dinner on its show, and today the tables have turned. And we'll listen in on segments from past episodes of the Agro Innovations Podcast, featuring well-known figures like Paul Stamets, a mycologist, aka mushroom specialist from Olympia, Washington. We'll hear from the UK's Rob Hopkins, who has popularized the Transition Town movement, a movement that seeks to equip communities to respond to the challenges of climate change and peak oil. And we'll hear from Montana journalist and author Richard Manning, who possesses a keen interest in the history and future of the American prairie and agriculture. The Agro Innovations Podcast is based in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and is hosted weekly by Frank Aragona. Having now produced 70 episodes, the podcast delves into some of the more technical and hands-on sides of topics that Deconstructing Dinner likes to examine each week. It's certainly a podcast that we highly recommend, and we're happy to be sharing just some segments from past episodes of the show today. In the first half of today's episode, we'll dig into the Agro Innovation Archives and listen to segments from a July 2007 interview with Paul Stamets of Olympia, Washington. Paul is a mycologist and the well-known author of Mycelium Running. Paul runs Fungi Perfecti, a company specializing in using gourmet and medicinal mushrooms to improve the health of the planet and its people. While Deconstructing Dinner has explored the role of at-home mushroom cultivation, on this episode of the Agro Innovations Podcast, host Frank Aragona speaks with Paul on the history of mushrooms and the symbiosis between them and humans.
Hello and welcome to the AgroInnovations.com podcast, all things related and debated in agriculture. Today we are with Paul Stamets. Why don't we get started by you telling us about the role of mushrooms in human history? Now, I know you could probably talk an entire interview about that, but just give people a general idea of the role mushrooms have played in history.
Well, much of this has recently come to light because of the concentration on the fossil records. And I'd like to go way back in time to give people sort of the history of life in the universe, at least as far as we know it. 13.8 billion years ago, there was a Big Bang. We all know about that. And then the Earth coalesced out of stardust around 4.5 billion years ago. The first organisms appeared in the ocean, but the first organisms that came onto land were fungi. They appeared onto land about 1.3 billion years ago. They marched onto land, and plants followed 600 million years later. And so fungi munch rocks. They produce acids and enzymes that mineralize rocks. They take calcium and manganese and iron out of the rock mantle, and in doing so, crumble it. And so these are the vanguard species that enter into habitats, and then other organisms follow. Now, we have a more common ancestry with fungi than we do with any other kingdom. Actually, we are fungi are our ancestors. We split from fungi 600 million years ago. In the Journal of Eukaryotic Microbiology, a new superkingdom was proposed. I think 25 eukaryotic microbiologists co-authored this paper, and they proposed Opisthokonta as a new superkingdom, joining Animalia and fungi together. We are animals, of course, and we respire carbon dioxide, so do fungi. Fungi inhale oxygen, just like we do. We have lots of other similarities. And we, as we split from fungi, fungi went underground, so to speak, and we went overground. We digest our nutrients internally, and we have specialized organs like lungs and brains and stomachs. So when the fungi went underground, they produced this filamentous mat called mycelium, and these are very fine, thin, thread-like cells that form networks. And these networks are very interesting because the mycelium digests its nutrients externally and then draws in those nutrients that it needs through its cell walls. But these cell walls are very thin, but the mycelium is pervasive in most all soils. There's up to 8 miles of mycelium in a single cubic inch. And the largest organism in the world is the mycelial mat, thus far known, in eastern Oregon, over 2,000 acres in size, and yet it's one cell wall thick. Now, we have 5 or 6 skin layers that protect us from infection. The mycelium has one, and it's surrounded by all sorts of millions of hungry microbes that want to consume it because it is so nutritious. How is it the largest organism in the world can be one cell wall thick? And these are highly evolved organisms, and these mycelial mats are in constant biomolecular communication with the ecosphere, and they can articulate their defenses custom-specific to the antagonists that they encounter. So the mycelium serves as lungs because it's respiring CO2 and inhaling oxygen. It is an externalized stomach because it's digesting its nutrients outside of a cellular network and drawing in the nutrients that it needs. And I propose that these are neurobiological landscapes and that mycelium, I know, is sentient. And I have a deep belief that mycelium is inherently intelligent. And these vast neuromycological networks pervade all ecosystems, and they really are the foundation of the food web. Life has emerged off of roughly 6 inches of soil. And the fungi are the grand molecular disassemblers in nature, and they give rise to plant and animal communities through the soil matrix that they are creating. So this is a foundational platform of life, and fungi break down rocks, create soil, recycle plant and animal after they die, and in doing so, humus is created. So that kind of gives you a rough idea about how fungi have entered into the landscape. But what really has steered evolution and symbiosis with fungi, to the best of our knowledge, is two cataclysmic events. There was an asteroid impact on Earth 250 million years ago. And when the asteroid hit the Earth, there was a huge amount of debris was jettisoned into the atmosphere. The skies darkened with dust. Light was choked off. And over 90% of the species, this is at the border of the Permian and the Triassic period, became extinct. And this massive loss of species obviously fueled lots of debris fields, and the fungi surged, and fungi inherited the Earth. Those organisms that paired with fungi, since fungi do not require light, then benefited, and through natural selection, they were favored, and they surged to the forefront. Now, species diversification occurred, and we marched forward to 65 million years ago, and bam, we get hit by another asteroid. There's a recurring theme here, folks. and the same thing happened. The skies were darkened, light was shut off, and fungi re-inherited the Earth. Through these two cataclysmic asteroid events, pairing with fungi was rewarded. And so those organisms, animals, insects, and plants that pair with fungi had an added advantage in terms of gathering nutrients and being able to survive these long periods of darkness. Now, there's other factors, of course, that have rewarded symbiosis, but this is just two examples. In the Journal of Geology, 2 months ago, there was an excellent article that was produced speaking to a fossil group that's been a mystery for over 150 years. And around 1850, I think the first fossil of Prototaxides was found in Saudi Arabia. And they've also found these fossils in Quebec and elsewhere. I think there's several dozen of these fossils have been found. And according to the geological record, they existed 420 million years ago. 420 million years ago, the tallest plants on Earth were under 2 feet tall. And yet this Protosaxides, which scientists now believe is a mushroom, stood 30 feet tall and was 4 feet in diameter. So 420 million years ago, the tallest organisms on the planet of Earth were these giant mushrooms. And then plants ascended. We don't know why these things don't exist today, but 99% of the species that have ever existed are now extinct. And that's an interesting concept, that we're less than 1% of the species that we see today is of all the species that have ever existed. But we march forward, and the oldest mushrooms found in amber is 100 million years old. Now, if you go back 100 million years ago and you walk through the forest and you saw mushrooms, you would recognize them. But if you looked around for something that looked like a human, there would be nothing in your viewscape or on Earth that even resembled hominids whatsoever. Mushrooms had their form long before we had ours. And there's a form of biological racism, unfortunately, that I've been confronting all of my life, and people are prejudiced against mushrooms. You say mushrooms, and people think portobellos are magic mushrooms. But very few people have any clue that we evolved from fungi, and fungi are our ancestors. And understanding how they emerge through these landscapes and how they have a mothering influence to the benefit of the ecological community becomes a big surprise to those who are not familiar with the subject. It's an extremely exciting field right now, because through the theater of evolution, there's been, you know, more than a billion years of experiments in nature that I think we can benefit from. And that's what I'm really focused on, is looking at that which nature has already invented and seeing how we can apply it or cross-apply it to some of the catastrophia that humans are committing today.
So let's fast forward a little bit and talk about the emergence of civilizations, the formation of communities. How have people interacted with mushrooms, and how have mushrooms shaped the course of history?
Excellent question. The famous Iceman that was found in the fall of, I believe, 1991 on the border of Austria and Italy, is the best preserved remains of a human so far found in a quote-unquote natural setting, which means he wasn't buried. And he apparently died from an infection from an arrowhead in his back. And the Iceman had with him two polypore mushrooms. Now, these are wood shelf conch mushrooms. They're in the shape of a hoof, and they often are mostly are attached to trees. And one mushroom that he had in particular has been known throughout the ages as amadou. And amadou is the Latin name for the mushroom is Fomes fomentarius. It's a birch polypore. So they are very common in birch forests throughout the world. And this mushroom is a fire starter mushroom. You can hollow this mushroom out, put embers of a fire in it, and keep fire alive for days. This literally allowed and helped the migration of humans out of Africa into Europe. Because when we moved out of Africa into Europe, we discovered something new called winter. And oops, and if you didn't have fire, your clan would die. And so having the portability of fire enabled human migration and to keep fire alive. And the firekeeper of any clan, of course, historically has been an extremely important role. So this wood conch, when you boil it in water and you pound it, it separates into the fibers which are mycelium. And when you pound this mushroom after you boil it in water, it separates into a fabric. And this fabric is highly flammable. And it also revolutionized warfare, because this is literally the punk that enabled flint spark rifles to work, because the spark would fall onto this mycelial fabric, which is highly flammable. It would then burn, and then it would ignite the gunpowder. So this mushroom also revolutionized warfare. And, of course, any clan or tribe or group that had these weapons versus a tribe that did not would have a strong competitive advantage. There's dozens of examples such as this, but mushrooms have been played a pivotal role. And 10,000 years ago, we were forest people. We were in intimate contact with nature. We were dependent upon the forest ecosystems. Our body intellect of knowledge of fungi in the ecosystem, I think 10,000 years ago, exceeds, from a practical point of view, the knowledge that we have today.
So could you talk a little bit about when people started cultivating mushrooms? What species were they? Did they start cultivating? How was it done, and where did this occur?
The first species, well, being woods people, we would gather wood for fires. And so it's hard to say when this was first noticed, but no doubt in my mind it goes back hundreds of thousands of years, in that when you collect firewood, and this is seen today, and you have it by your house, and if it gets wet, mushrooms sprout from the wood. Well, in Asia, the shiitake mushroom was first discovered. It's interesting. The Chinese say that they discovered it. The Koreans say that they discovered it. The Japanese say that they discovered it, that you could grow shiitake mushrooms on wood. No doubt there's a common truth amongst the three claims. And a wood gathering people would notice that these very, very, very delicious shiitake mushrooms would fruit on the wood that they gathered. And they also realized if you took freshly cut wood and you put it in between the logs or limbs that were producing the shiitake, the spore cast from the mushrooms, drifting a few inches, would land on the adjacent log, and then those logs would become infected or inoculated, and then that way they could perpetually keep the shiitake mushrooms in culture. In Europe, the cultivation of button mushrooms really was pioneered in France, and it was one of the gardeners of one of the kings, I think it's King Louis XIV, and I have to go back to my notes to check on that, and realizing that the mushrooms were growing on horse paddocks, and then looking for a moist, constant temperature-controlled environment, there was a nearby cave, and compost was taken down into the cave, and it turned out to be a wonderful environment to grow mushrooms. So there's two separate paths, but clearly the Eurasians and Asians preceded the Western Europeans by several hundred, if not several thousand years.
This is Deconstructing Dinner. On today's episode, we're listening to segments from the Agro Innovations Podcast, a weekly program on food and agriculture out of Albuquerque, New Mexico. More info on their podcast is at agroinnovations.com/podcast. In this first half hour of the show, we're listening to segments from an interview with mycologist Paul Stamets, the author of the popular book Mycelium Running. Paul lives in Olympia, Washington. Here again is Agro Innovations Podcast host, Frank Aragona.
So let's talk a little bit about yourself. And certainly modern technology has impacted our ability to cultivate mushrooms, and you are probably the quintessential example of that. Tell us how you got started as a mushroom cultivator.
Well, okay. I first was fascinated with the cultivation of the magic mushrooms, psilocybin mushrooms. And I was in the woods a lot hunting for these mushrooms. I could never find them, but I found lots of edibles. And I steered towards those and learned how to identify several dozen edible and poisonous species. And eventually went to the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. And my interest refocused on the psilocybin active species. And I was covered by a Drug Enforcement Administration license for over 20 years through Dr. Michael Bug, who is my professor and a very good organic chemist who published actually some of the protocols that the DEA still uses today for the accurate analysis of psilocybin content. My focus was taxonomy and scanning electron microscopy, and I spent a lot of time in front of the electron microscope. And in the winter times, I didn't have fresh specimens. And so I honed my culture skills so I could start looking at mycelium and primordia and morphological development of these mushrooms, because they lead to taxonomic features that are significant. Most people may not know that the majority of mushrooms, at the earliest stages of their formation, much like an embryo with humans, their features are defined. And so looking at these mushrooms at a very young state gave me a lot of information on the morphological development of the mushrooms that lead to taxonomically significant features. So I pursued that for a long time, and I have published four new species in the genus Psilocybe, all of which still survive today. I'm happy to say that, because a lot of species are thrown out or thought to be conspecific with other names, and so it's the way of taxonomy, names change. But my species concepts and are still valid taxa. And then I've also published some other non-psychoactive species that I have found in nature or have participated with others. So that really led into my cultivation skills. But then I became more and more fascinated about fungi in the ecosystem. And mushrooms have a tendency to follow catastrophic events. Who knew? It's, you know, also related to this, to the deep evolutionary history of these fungi, responding to catastrophia, whether that catastrophia is your foot breaking a stick or whether it's an asteroid hitting the Earth, these fungi surge up to capture newly available nutrients. And so I was fascinated by debris trails. And humans create enormous debris trails as we walk around, as we walk across landscapes, and we build houses and we cut the forest. So the fungi that are associated with humans became a focus of mine, and the majority of the psilocybe mushrooms are intimately associated with human activity. So if you want to find psilocybe mushrooms in the Northwest, you can go to any building, landscaping area that has used wood chips. And classically, those are universities, churches, law enforcement facilities, courthouses, schoolyards, etc. So the bark mulching or wood chip mulching around buildings for landscaping caused a huge surge in these species, which were otherwise very rarely found in nature in the wild. I mean, to this day, I've never found Psilocybe sinensis and Strictipes and a number of other species in truly wild environments. They're all closely and intimately associated with human activity. As my research continued, then I got more and more interested in the medicinal properties of mushrooms. And so my horizons quickly expanded. And though I am an expert on psilocybin mushrooms, and I've published a lot on that subject, my more recent work in the past 10 years has been more focused on gourmet and medicinal mushrooms.
You have often argued, and you've suggested that as you're speaking today, that mushroom mycelium is one of the key components missing in sustainable food production. Could you explain what you mean by this?
Well, because fungi recycle and because fungi create soils, a big missing component that I see in permaculture and in other agricultural practices, people talk about soil without really defining how it's made or the processes that lead to its making. And this is where engaging fungi enhances soil development far faster if you knowingly and purposely introduce fungi on, for instance, wood chips or corn stalks or wheat or grasses or anything that's a consequence of farming or forestry. You can recycle those nutrients quickly into the soil bank. We generate soil here. When we grow shiitake mushrooms on sawdust, we can create beautiful, dark, chernozem-like soil in a matter of 3 to 4 months. And some people have said it takes 1,000 years to develop an inch of soil. You know, true from one perspective. If you actively engage fungi and steer their decomposition specifically, you can generate soil within a year. And so soil enhancement and the adverse soil, the loss of soil, is what is impugning the food chains and causing famines and leads to drought and desertification, because thickening the humus and recycling these plant and animal nutrients back into the carbon bank thickens the soil, increasing its carrying capacity, leading to higher, more and more biodiversity, and a more biodiverse ecosystem that is constructed, so to speak, on thickening soils leads to greater sustainability, and thinning soils leads to less sustainability. For 3 years, I actually was a logger, and young men, I think, have this death wish, you know, when they're between 18 and 25, and it could be testosterone poisoning, who knows, but I think as a group, young men like to test themselves and see what they're made of, and maybe that was my urge. And I was a long-haired hippie and went into the woods and unfortunately cut down the old-growth forest. And I was mesmerized and conflicted, you know, going into these old-growth forests that are so beautiful, and then the chainsaws would start in the morning, and by the afternoon, you'd see sky, and all of the trees would be laying down, and a massive evaporation, massive heat increase. And then the logging trucks, some of these logging trucks were three log loads, three logs on a logging truck. The trees were that big. And I was wondering to myself, where's all this carbon coming from? I can see where it's going. It's going on the logging trucks. But where did it come from? And then if you think back now, and for what's happened, we're in the third generation to fourth generation forests now here in the Northwest, except for the 5% of the old growth forests that still remain. Let's just go back in time again. 1900, you know, the first European settlers came to the Northwest, and they cut the forests, usually near to the waterways, near to the salt water or near rivers, because they could float the logs. So 1900, they first cut the forests, and then they burned. So that's two insults on the carbon bank. Now, two insults on the carbon bank of soil that was built only in 10,000 years, because the last ice age ended about 10,000 years ago, and as the ice receded, it scraped the soil and flushed it into the ocean. Anyone seen this around who's watched glaciers recede? It's a moraine, gravelly-like non-soil that is left, and there's small lenses of soil that do survive, and these lenses then rebound, and the plant successions occur, and they die, and the lens gets a little bit bigger. Well, it's mycelium that's creating that through the entire process. So 1900, we cut the forest, we burn up two insults on the carbon bank. 1950, there's a second cut, and they cut, and they burn again. So that's four insults on the carbon bank. Year 2000, or in this period now, the forests are cut a third time, and then they're burned. Six insults on a carbon bank, which took 10,000 years to create. Now, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to understand that is not sustainable. And as a result, we get premature decline. Trees are toppling earlier because the root wads can't support the trees because the soil's not there. And so the logging industry goes, uh-oh, we better cut the trees sooner. And so we're going down a slippery slope of diminishing returns, and this is not sustainable. And so I think engaging these fungi and getting them to actively recycle nutrients is a way of it's a much better path than that which has been practiced. And I'm opposed to burning. I know it's controversial for people around Lake Tahoe right now because a lot of those million-dollar homes have burned up because of the brush control has been restricted. But, you know, we are a species that has invaded a native landscape. And I think that we have to have some sensibilities about how to live within the ecosystem in such a way that our children will also enjoy it. The problem that I think we face in the world today is the eagerness for short-term benefits and not looking downstream into future generations. You know, if our ancestors had behaved the way that we are behaving now 2,000 years ago, and indeed in some places they have, you know, the ecosystems would not be thriving as well as they are today. And I think that, you know, a clear example is I've been to Shanghai twice, and Shanghai has committed ecological suicide. There's no way there's enough plants that are producing enough oxygen for the city of Shanghai. In fact, a well-known ecologist that I was in correspondence with told me that there was no amphibians within 30 miles of Shanghai. There's no frogs, no amphibians. And he was absolutely in despair because he was basing his studies on prior work talking about the biodiversity in the landscapes around Shanghai. Now, take Shanghai as an example. If that's our model, and if we look into our glass ball into the future, and if the whole planet becomes like Shanghai, well, obviously, there's not going to be enough oxygen, and we're going to have a tremendous collapse of ecosystems, including the ecosystems that support us. And so we need to come into balance with our growth, with our population growth, and how these ecosystems are protected and preserved, because protecting and preserving them is preserving our own future and that of our descendants.
That does it for part one of our interview with Paul Stamets. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Frank Aragona. This is the AgroInnovations.com podcast. Saludos.
Deconstructing Dinner is made possible by the generous support from the G. Raymond Chang School of Continuing Education Certificate in Food Security at Ryerson University. The Chang School offers you food for thought in your exploration of food issues and impacts, including urban agriculture. For more information about this unique distance education program, visit ryerson.ca/CE/food security.
This is Deconstructing Dinner, a weekly radio show and podcast produced in Nelson, British Columbia, at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY. I'm John Steinman. If you miss any of today's episode, it is archived online at deconstructingdinner.ca and posted under the November 19th, 2009 episode. Today's show is featuring segments from the Agro Innovations Podcast, a weekly program produced in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Back in January 2009, Deconstructing Dinner was featured on the podcast, and today we're happy to share some of their work here. That last interview featured Paul Stamets, a mycologist from Olympia, Washington, and the full 1 hour of that interview can be heard by visiting agroinnovations.com/podcast. In the next half hour, we'll listen to more segments from Agro Innovations featuring author and journalist Richard Manning, who spoke to Frank Aragona on the role that annual grasses have played in shaping agriculture and civilization. But first, a short segment with the UK's Rob Hopkins, who has popularized the Transition Town movement, a movement that seeks to equip communities to respond to the challenges of climate change and peak oil. Here's a short segment from that November 2009 interview.
Hello and welcome to episode number 69 of the AgroInnovations podcast, all things related and debated in agriculture. I'm your host, Frank Aragona. All of our episodes are available online, free of charge, at agroinnovations.com/podcast. We have many previous episodes online of the AgroInnovations podcast, full of information that is useful for gardeners, permaculturalists, food activists, and people who are just generally interested in issues related to sustainable agriculture and agricultural technology, peak oil, climate change, all of the issues that are very important in our day and age. Today on the AgroInnovations podcast, we are joined by Rob Hopkins. Rob is a permaculture practitioner and teacher and author of many books, including The Transition Handbook, From Oil Dependence to Local Resilience, and also the founder of The Transition Network. Rob also blogs at transitionculture.org. Rob Hopkins, welcome to the AgroInnovations podcast.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
What are the origins of the transition culture?
Well, the transition idea came around, started forming, I suppose, in around 2004 when I was teaching permaculture at a college in Ireland, and I found out about peak oil. And I started to, I got my second year students to do a project where they looked at the town of Kinsale, where the course was, and tried to design, using permaculture principles, a pathway away from oil dependency for the town. And we spent a long time looking around the world thinking somebody else must have thought about this. somebody else must be on the case with this already, and we couldn't find anybody who'd even started thinking about it really in any sort of tangible way. So the project that they did was just trying to look across food, energy, housing, building, what that move away from oil dependency might look like if it was based on the idea that you start with a vision of how you'd like it to be and then you backcast as to how you would actually get there. And the resultant plan was something that became quite viral on the internet, and it was lots and lots of places started getting rather excited about it. And then later that year, I then moved back to the UK, which is where I was from originally, to Totnes in Devon, and then that was when we started an initiative here that wasn't called Transition Town Totnes to start with, but after a year or so we started to call it that. And really that was when we started to design the model. And I think really for me it's like what transition is. It's a bit like how in music, you know, a lot of the most exciting innovations in music come when people think, what happens if you put this with this? You know, what happens if you put that kind of music over the beat from that kind of music? You get a whole new genre of music. And so for me, really, where transition emerged from was trying to design a response to peak oil using permaculture principles.
In the process of developing this, you have articulated a 12-step approach. What is this 12-step approach, and how exactly does it work?
There are 12 of them largely by accident, but actually I quite like the thing that it's like an addictions model, because our relationship with fossil fuels in the West is such an addictive and such a dependent relationship. But that came about because after we'd been doing stuff here in Totnes for a while, we got people from other communities getting in touch saying, what are you doing and how do you do that exactly? And we had no idea really, because we had very much made it up spontaneously on the hoof as we'd gone along really. And it was a kind of a distilling of very eclectic inspirations from psychology and environmental activism and you know, a whole range of different disciplines. So we started just pulling together what some of those ingredients were that underpinned it, based on what we'd been doing in Totnes. So the first one is forming a steering group and designing its demise from the outset, which is based on the idea of trying to get away from groups just getting stuck in the fact that they're a group, but that it actually designs for its own evolution as the process goes along. And then it moves into awareness raising, and a lot of transition groups spend their first year or so doing a lot of awareness raising, because really what transition groups act as is as a catalyst. It's not a process that comes in with all of the ideas already in a little bag and sort of and takes them all out. It's really a process which is about catalyzing the community to design its own response. So that awareness raising stage is really, really important. Then there's all around laying the foundations, about networking with other organizations that are already there, because it's, you know, the chances are you're not going to be the first organization that ever thought a green thought in the history of the town. Then there's having what we call an unleashing, which is the kind of the launch event. It's designed to be a celebration of the place and of the local culture, and in such a way that designed to be the evening people will look back to historically as the point where it all began. Then groups start to form around specific subjects like energy and housing, and that brings out the people who are really passionate about that subject, because transition is designed to be a process driven not by guilt and despair and angst, but rather to be driven by what it is that people are really passionate about and what really fires them up.
Rob Hopkins of the Transition Town Movement, interviewed in November 2009 on the Agro Innovations podcast. The full interview with Rob can be heard online at agroinnovations.com/podcast. This is Deconstructing Dinner. And taking us to the end of today's episode, we'll listen to another sample from the Agro Innovations podcast featuring Montana author and journalist Richard Manning. Richard has authored a number of books on agriculture and civilization, and AgroInnovation's Frank Aragona spoke with Richard in August 2008. They spoke of the beginning of agriculture and the role that annual grasses have played in shaping agriculture and civilization.
Hello, welcome to the AgroInnovations.com podcast, all things related and debated in agriculture. Today we are with Richard Manning, who is the author of several books and essays, including Against the Grain, How Agriculture Has Hijacked Civilization, Grassland, The History, Politics, Biology, and Promise of the American Prairie, and the essay, The Oil We Eat, Following the Food Chain Back to Iraq. Richard, thanks for joining us today on the Agro-Innovations Podcast.
Oh, thanks very much for having me.
Let's start with some of the things that you've written about quite extensively, which is the development of agriculture and the transition from a hunter-gatherer society to a sedentary agricultural society. Can you give us a brief summary of this transition and some of its key points?
Well, that's probably the pivotal point in human history. I mean, it's when we became something different than what we had been for a very long time. If we were to mark our transition to humans, that's probably, depending on where you put the mark, 300,000 years ago, 200,000, something on that order. And for a very short period of that, the last 10,000 years, we've been farmers, agriculturalists. For all of the rest of the time, 97-98% of the time, we were hunter-gatherers. And why that's relevant is that we became what we are through evolution as hunter-gatherers, a very different mode of existence. Basically, we ate differently, much differently than we eat today. We lived differently. We were nomadic. We tended to wander around a lot. We were not as organized. All those things were the conditions of our existence, and when you have conditions of your existence, you evolve. Not only that, the planet evolved with that sort of existence. In other words, wild systems, and we changed those to farm systems almost overnight, 10,000 years ago. And so I regard that last 10,000 years as an experiment, almost. And the results of that are mixed, at best, at the very best. But that's, I think, the kind of the context for the discussion that we need to have today.
Can you talk about how agriculture has been a force and a mechanism in European imperialism and the conquest of indigenous cultures?
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting in that it comes out most strongly in the European tradition. I mean, basically, there are three or four traditions of domestication, depending on which ones you look at, around three or four different crops, certainly wheat. And that's the one we talk about the most, and I talk about the most, but also rice, which was the Asian domestication, corn, which was the Central American domestication, and potatoes. I mean, if we look at those four crops, they really explain pretty much all of human history. Well, European history is wound up in wheat. It's based in wheat agriculture, which was domesticated in the Middle East, and I think it's no accident at all that the Middle East is our most troubled spot on the planet today. It's a direct result of this. But all of these things have something in common. They're all annual grasses. Humans are grass eaters. We basically eat the seeds. We derive something like 70% of our nutrition from the seeds of grasses. And they're not only grasses, they're an interesting kind of grass. They're an annual grass, which means that they set seed every year and die. They're not perennial plants. So it's a kind of a minority strategy in the plant world. But as a result of that, they deplete the soil as opposed to build up the soil as most other plants do. And that's key. That is absolutely the bedrock fact of domestication, that we domesticated annual grasses that deplete the soil. And because they deplete the soil, we have to move on. So we raise wheat for a long time in a landscape, or not a long time at all, sometimes 10, 15 years. It's no longer capable of raising that wheat any longer, and so we move on. That simple fact was the engine of imperialism for Europe. I mean, and it started about 6,000 years ago, and it has never stopped. Or it didn't stop until about 1960, when we had really farmed all the new land. We'd move on as far as you could go onto anything that would raise wheat. We was raising wheat. At that point, we adopted a somewhat different strategy of taking hydrocarbons, that is, chemical fertilizer, to replace that fertility in the soil. So we are now moving on to different lands. They're just oil-bearing lands as opposed to wheat-bearing lands. And so it was a different sort. But that fact that wheat, the annual grass, depleted the soil was the determining factor of imperialism, and it's what drove everything that came since.
Now, the title of your book is very compelling, How Agriculture Has Hijacked Civilization. How has agriculture hijacked civilization?
Well, in the long terms we've been talking about here and thinking about it, in biological terms, we say, well, you know, the humans conquered the world, and they did so as a result of agriculture and their ability to store food. So we could range all over the place. But in biological terms, it's every bit as accurate and as valid and as illuminating to say wheat conquered the world or dandelions conquered the world, because there are this collection of species, this coalition of plants around wheat that are every bit as successful as humans are. And that's what counts in biology. If you propagate and take over new territory, you're a successful species. So wheat took over a new species, just as dandelions did, just as spotted knapweed did, just as horses did. So there are a number of coalition, or members of this coalition around plants and animals. And if you think of this for a while, it's every bit as accurate from the wheat's point of view, I know that sounds strange, but think of it for a second. From the wheat's point of view, to say wheat domesticated humans, because these plants use us to propagate their genes and spread their genes around the world. And so it's that necessity of that coalition that really determines how we live, the way we live, the fact that we're imperialistic, the fact that we farm, the fact that we plow, the fact that we burn hydrocarbons. And it's the demand of those annual grasses that is so deterministic, it's such a driving force in human civilization, it's almost accurate to say, or I think it is accurate to say, that the plants hijacked us, and that farming hijacked us in a way, and converted humans to its own purpose. And so that's kind of the derivation of that. It's also an irony to say that at the same time, because, of course, civilization itself, the concept is based in agriculture. In other words, what we think of as civilization, living in cities, writing, having leisure time, philosophy, cultural evolution, all those things are based in the fact that we were able to have that because of agriculture, because we had leisure time, because we could build cities, because we could raise armies. So agriculture, in a way, created civilization, but at the same time, it determined the flow of that civilization and the outlines of it.
You've also written extensively about the loss and potential recovery of grasslands and prairies. What are some of the key points about these vital ecosystems and how we manage them that you think the listeners should know about?
Yeah, and that gets right at the heart of the matter, the fact that prairie is a very different animal. And in fact, all other ecosystems, if we look at farming, the average cultivated field, and I mentioned soil depletion, what that really does is allow organic matter in the soil to decay. So if we look at prairie soils in the American Midwest that are now solely used to raise corn, when the settlers first came there, they had something like 9 to 10 to 12% organic matter. They're now down in the area of 5, 4% organic matter. And that's huge. I mean, that's an enormous change. And what is happening there is farming inevitably depletes organic matter. And in the process, by the way, releasing carbon dioxide, which is another part of this story. But that stands in sharp distinction to every other ecosystem. And the farming course is not an ecosystem. But every natural ecosystem, be it prairie, be it forest, be it even desert, adds organic matter to the soil. And the difference, of course, is perennial plants. So prairie is based in perennial plants, a grass that doesn't set seed every year, but in fact lives from year to year. And usually there are two types of grasses in every prairie, a cool season and a warm season grass. Every prairie has some sort of legume in it, and the value of these things is they fix nitrogen in the soil. So they actually pull nitrogen out of the air to fertilize the whole business. And then everyone has a yellow composite sunflower of some kind, yellow composite flower. And those things go together to do something called overyielding, meaning if you grow them separately, then they are less than they would be if you grow them all together. It's as simple as that. And that over-yielding is what is really important and the principle we've lost in farming. So it's permaculture. It can go on forever. It builds the soil. It produces far more biomass than farming does. And it's really where we need to get our instructions on where we go forward, by going back to the prairie, by understanding how it works, and by creating a farming that mimics that so we can go on indefinitely into the future.
Montana author and journalist Richard Manning, interviewed on the weekly Agro Innovations podcast. This is Deconstructing Dinner, where we've been featuring segments from the weekly Agro Innovations podcast out of Albuquerque, New Mexico. The entire interview with Richard Manning is archived on their website at agroinnovations.com/podcast. But to take us to the end of today's show, we'll leave you with one last segment from that interview, where Richard shares some thoughtful remarks on how each of us can find our place within our communities and help work towards ensuring a stable and ecologically sound food supply for today and for future generations. Here again, Frank Aragona.
Yeah, and let's talk about some of these alternatives. As you've written extensively about food systems, one of the things you've stated is that there are little niches in every system, and each person's individual charge is to find such niches. Could you explain to people what those niches might be and how to find them?
Yeah, one of the ways we went wrong with industrial agriculture and the Green Revolution is do these one-size-fits-all solutions. So in other words, it was deliberately done that way. I mean, it was not an accident at all. We wanted one kind of wheat that would grow any place in the world, and then you would force the conditions through irrigation and fertilizer to allow that to happen. The antithesis to that approach is to say, no, we need to do what is locally appropriate, not only in terms of what people like to eat, but what will grow there in terms of the weather, the cropping system, but also the respect things like the parasites and the diseases. So, you know, if you have a lot of particular rice disease, rice blast, for instance, in a given area, then you grow crops that are resistant to that. And so we're becoming much more refined in our ability to think about niches, to think about what's appropriate in a small place, and to really to do the kind of science necessary to exploit those niches. And that's the very situation I was talking about, for instance, with grass-fed beef in the Midwest. Those people looked for a niche. They said, we don't like doing agriculture this way. What else can we do? They looked at the conditions of the landscape, saying, well, this place grows grass well. It did so when it was a tall grass prairie. And they looked very seriously at cattle, saying, well, the cattle today are wrong for this, but there are varieties of cattle and ways of raising cattle that are correct for this. What do those look like? In some cases, they went back to the 1950s methods and 1950s genetics to do it. And by thinking through the complexity of their area and even thinking about their market, you know, what will people eat in the Twin Cities area, they were able to put together a successful solution that works in their niche. And that's the key. And that's what's really incumbent on all of us. There's no one solution that's going to solve all this. There's no magic bullet. It's a question of inhabiting your landscape.
Now, how can an individual do this effectively? What advice would you give to someone who's listening to this and says, well, I'd really like to find my niche, but it's all kind of overwhelming. How do I start?
Well, there are a lot of people working on it, and I will bet anyone listening to this that if you look in your area, you'll already find people working on it, local foodscape ideas and people thinking about local agriculture, local sustainable agriculture. So you plug into that right away. You begin and you say, oh, who else is working on this? Where can I buy these kinds of foods that are either grown locally or grown sustainably in some way? And you find you'll get an education pretty quickly that way. You know, it's much easier to do this than it was 20 years ago. But also, when you do that, do it with a little bit of criticism or with a critical eye and simply say, you know, yeah, there's a lot of mythology in farming about, especially even about locally sustainable stuff. So what's really true about this? What really works in one way or another? Be willing to pursue unconventional approaches to things. I live in Montana, and one of the solutions that I do, that many of my friends do here locally, is to hunt. We take venison and we feed ourselves with that. Well, you know, that kind of solution isn't making it onto kind of the the national barometer or the national headlines. And in fact, it's probably not appropriate in most places, and people would object to it. But here it works perfectly, and it's worked that way for a long time. So, you know, think about your situation. Think in totality. Think about energy. Think about burning wood, for instance, those kinds of things that go on. It's not just about food. And you use your intelligence. You'll find out that it's a fun process once you get involved in it and try to inhabit your own landscape, because it's really quite educational and it's enriching. In the end, it connects you to a place and connects you to your food in a fairly rewarding fashion.
Is there anything in this interview that we didn't touch on that you think that's important for people to know about or hear?
Well, the one thing I'd tell people is people have fun with this. And I know that runs counter to, you know, there's this gloom and doom that pervades this discussion. And I'm not saying that that's not appropriate. There is a lot of gloom and doom there. But we also can't throw out the fact that we're humans, we're part of our culture, and our culture depends on our food in a lot of ways. I mean, ceremony, the idea of family togetherness, ritual, holidays, all marked by food. And so think of the role that plays, and you don't throw out baby with bathwater. Think about how food enriches your life and how you can enjoy this. And you'll find that I think that by demanding, first of all, good food, food that you can enjoy, food that's appropriate, that you do some good and at the same time you have a good time. And that's appropriate too.
Well, Richard Manning, thank you so much for joining us on the AgroInnovations podcast. I especially take to heart your suggestion that people should have fun with this and maybe lay off a little bit on the gloom and doom. I think that's a great suggestion. And there's just so much work to be done and so much enjoyment to be gotten from that work I think it's really great and helpful to have a reminder from a person like yourself.
Well, thanks for having me.
That does it for this episode of the AgroInnovations podcast. Once again, I'd like to thank Richard Manning for joining us. I'm your host, Frank Aragona. This is the AgroInnovations podcast. Saludos.
This is Deconstructing Dinner, and a thanks to Frank Aragona and the AgroInnovations podcast for sharing their interviews here on the show today, including that last one with Montana author and journalist Richard Manning. Among Richard's books is his 2007 release, Against the Grain, How Agriculture Has Hijacked Civilization. The full interview with Richard can be heard at agroinnovations.com/podcast, and today's full episode of Deconstructing Dinner is archived on our site at deconstructingdinner.ca and posted under the November 19th, 2009 episode. And that was this week's edition of Deconstructing Dinner, produced and recorded at Nelson, British Columbia's Kootenai Co-op Radio. I've been your host, John Steinman. The theme music for Deconstructing Dinner is courtesy of Nelson area resident Adam Shake. This radio show is provided free of charge to campus community radio stations across the country and relies on the financial support from you, the listener. Support for the program can be donated through our website at deconstructingdinner.ca or by dialing 250-352-9600.